Welcome to Tilt Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking with Dan Smith, the agronomy badger from UW-Madison Division of Extension. And with me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilt Agronomy. Right, so we want to welcome to the podcast for, we were trying to figure it out, either the third or fourth time, UW-Madison Nutrient or NPM Project Manager, Program Manager. Boy, I'm just messing this up all over the place, Dan. And the Agronomy Badger, Dan Smith. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks, Matt. We always do these towards the end of the year or the beginning of the year. A lot of fun. Always chatting with kind of what's new and what's been going on the last year. I bring a little bit of a Southern Wisconsin perspective, but I think what we'll chat about will have implications for your farm, no matter where it is. And I'm really excited to chat today.
Dan still has the best name with the Agronomy Badger. It's just the coolest name ever, Dan. And glad to have you back. This is always exciting to talk to just somebody with so much knowledge and the coolest name ever.
Yeah, the extension pantheon of Badger Crop Doc, Cool Bean, and the best name is the Agronomy Badger.
I couldn't believe it was free. I'll admit that I like sharing photos of the plots and different things throughout the year on there. I didn't do that as much this year, but it's always a lot of fun to share that stuff. And yeah, lucky to have the name, I guess.
So did you get your first choice or did you have to go through a couple before you got that one?
That was the first choice. I kind of played around with like different nuances of it because at the time I was working in Southern Wisconsin. So I was like thinking maybe Driftless Agronomy, Badgered, you know, just different plays on it. And there's a limit on that, or at least there was, on how long those things could be. And then finally settled on the Agronomy Badger. And then there's been other people trying and copy it, of course, here at the University of wanting to make plays on it. And trying to fit it in the character limit of Agronomy Badgers is just about as long as you can have. So
everything's always for sale, Dan. Like
that's true.
It's like numbers when new players come into teams. You know, they pay the old guy for their number. So I mean, you never know. You might make a little on this deal.
That's right. That's right. I think there's probably quite a few rules against it. If somebody really wants it, maybe they'll really make a good trade for it. So
there you go.
Yeah, we were talking before we recorded. Your weather is a little bit nicer than ours the last few days, anyway. You guys are teetering on the white Christmas, but things are definitely a little bit on the warm side right now, which is surprising.
Yeah, we've had a crazy roller coaster since Thanksgiving. We've gotten a lot of snow, which is strange because the last few winters in southern Wisconsin have not provided a white Christmas, but they also haven't provided much snow. So to get as much snow as we did already, I don't know what our exact total here is, maybe 15, 16 inches of snow. I know I plowed for 3 or 4 hours on my tractor already, and I don't have much to plow. So we've plowed a lot of snow already for this early in the season. And then we've kept it up until this last week when we lost a lot of it. In fact, you can see a few patches getting pretty thin already. It was cool to see the snowmobile trails were open for a while, earlier than ever, that from what I remember my short time here living near Madison. And then it seemed like it was going to be a white Christmas, as you started out saying. But it's looking like too good of a weather week this week, which I guess I can't complain. I was at a conference this last week. It was 53 degrees in our neighboring state of Michigan. It's crazy to see. But yeah, the snow disappears in southern Wisconsin really quickly. So we'll see what winter has for us.
That's cool. They had the snowmobile trails open. How long about were they open? Like a week or only like 3-4 days?
Probably a good week.
Yeah.
Because it got so cold, which there wasn't obviously that many people out. I don't think it was attracting people from outside the area to come when it was like -5, but there was some good days that they were open for. They didn't open until later. They didn't open until after the 1st of December. There's apparently some rules about that. And then there was a lot of farm work still going on, of course. So some manure being hauled and in the eastern side of the county and some corn to be harvested, which I'm sure you guys have some stories about that up there too. So they didn't open the whole trail system right away, but yeah, they were open. I told my wife, Danny, that, hey, maybe it's the year we buy a sled because we finally have some snow early on. But now, you know, the week goes and I'm looking at my neighbor's snowmobile in their backyard right now. It's surrounded by grass. So maybe next year.
A week ago Tuesday, I had to head down to Madison to grab my daughter from college, and we were headed back and got as far as Beaver Dam, and there were still snowmobiles going on the trails as far north of Beaver Dam. So not around here, but yeah, you guys definitely got more than double probably what we got.
Yeah, it was so weird because even south of us, they got even more. I know Monroe, we had our Badger update meetings in Monroe, and they had a ton of snow compared to us, probably another 6-8 inches of snow they'd gotten down in southern Wisconsin that we did not get. And same goes from where I grew up. That Saturday after Thanksgiving, it snowed 8 inches, and that's uncalled for in that area.
Uncalled for, not unprecedented. You just don't even want it. It just isn't even. Illinois doesn't want that, Dan.
No. And, you know, my dad talks about they get one big snow a year, so it was definitely unpredicted, unprecedented, and uncalled for in that area. So.
All right. Well, to start things off, I think we want to hear about weed seed moving, because before we were recording, we were talking a little bit, and there's some different things kind of moving into the state here that maybe we don't want. And is there a return to sender that we can just, you know,
uncalled for,
send it back? It's uncalled for. Yes, we don't want these things here.
Yeah. So let's dive into the first one that we identified this year was Johnson grass. And Johnson grass is not new to the state. It's around. It's here and there. There's been some reports of it over the years. But what was interesting about Johnson grass this year was there's been some more field-wide cases reported. So we went out and visited one and confirmed that it was Johnson grass in Jefferson County this fall. And it was a field of corn, non-GMO corn. And so this field had not been sprayed with glyphosate, of course. And it was widespread. It was the entire field. It looked like, you know, a field full of any weed. You pick your weed, but it was the entire field was full of it. And it was Johnson grass. Johnson grass is a top 10 world's worst weed. So it's very unique for us in Wisconsin, unfortunately, something that we don't see. But other states really struggle with it. And it gets about 12 feet tall. So it's over the corn and produces a triangular seed head. So that was confirmed to be Johnson grass. And then after that, we have found it in 6 or 7 other counties in southern Wisconsin. So just this last week, I got another email saying, hey, I thought it was shattercane. I went back, looked at some of the pictures. Sure enough, it's Johnson grass. So
is the seed head, is that the main way you can tell the difference between shattercane and Johnson grass? Or what other, are there any other defining characteristics?
Yeah, the seed head is probably the best one for that windshield type survey. And the, oh, I thought it was Johnson, or I thought it was shattercane, go out and look at the seed head if it's that mature. The telltale signs are the rhizomes. So shattercane does not produce rhizomes. Johnson grass does. What's really unique about our Wisconsin population of Johnson grass is it doesn't appear to be overwintering. So the rhizomes are about the size of any finger on your hand, and they kind of curve up towards the soil surface, and some poke through the soil surface. We're on a true overwintering Johnson grass hybrid variety. Hybrid, I guess, is the right word for it. Those roots would fill a 5-gallon bucket very quickly, and it would be tough to dig one of those plants out of the ground. I have dug one of those plants out of the ground in the Greene County area. Definitely a one plant at least overwintered in that field, but did not overwinter in the fields that we looked at this year. All the plants were more like corn roots, very limited, came out of the ground very easily, did not have that extensive rhizome structure. And they kind of curl amongst themselves, the roots do, and they're just really tough to get out of the ground in those overwintering cases. And then the seed is quite a bit different, but that's, of course, we're getting to the late part of the season in that part. But the seed has almost like a black lab fur on it, almost, if you look at it under a magnifying glass. And shattercane, it looks a lot different than that as far as the seed goes. So some seed characteristics, roots are the easiest thing to look at early season. There's obviously the some differences in the ligule and the hairs on the leaves and different things if you're comparing Johnson grass to Shattercane. And then there was a lot of concern about this being a sorghum hybrid, sorghum almum, which was commonly planted in the 80s, especially in southern Wisconsin. That was what we predominantly thought we had. That was the stories from a lot of different people I talked to the last 5 or 6 years was, oh, that's sorghum. That's nothing to worry about. Well, it wasn't nothing to worry about because glyphosate was controlling it. But what we're seeing is Johnson grass is actually making its way into the state from wherever it's coming from. We're seeing a little bit more of it. Again, glyphosate's still controlling it because we're finding it on field edges, corners, spots where we miss spraying. But it's definitely causing some challenges for some producers in southern Wisconsin. So it's a weed that we're going to do more work on. Next spring, we're going to be releasing some info on some control, thinking about using some pre's against it, just thinking about ID, because we definitely don't want to be having some challenges like other states do with it.
Dan, you said on the Johnson grass, it was a conventional corn. What was their herbicide program?
I don't remember, Bill. It was heavy on the broadleaf weed control. Okay. The field was clean except for the Johnson grass. So I think it was a combination of things. It was one targeting probably water hemp in their control strategy, but also just completely leaving a grass tool out of the mix because it was the conventional hybrid.
That will be unique that of going after some of these other problem weeds mainly are more broadleaves that are we going to leave our grass control open? Do we got to, you know, just curious, do you know if you're seeing like dual or acetochlores or like new one with Zidua working a little better on Johnson grass, or are we still kind of in the infancy part of trying to target how we're going to combat this?
Still a little bit in the infancy stage for that one. But we can look to our neighbors out in Nebraska. They've done a lot of work on Johnson grass. That's actually Dr. Rodrigo Worley did a lot of work on that when he was out there for his degree programs. And he's the one that positively identified it. Because we were sure that it was Johnson grass based on the characteristics, but we were getting a lot of pushback saying this is that sorghum hybrid instead. Well, one look from Rodrigo said, no, this is Johnson grass. So now we're growing out the three in the greenhouse to have some good pictures to compare amongst ourselves, and then we'll publish all those soon. But as far as grass herbicides in general, we're seeing probably poorer and poorer grass control in some cases. So it's definitely going to be a moment to refocus probably the next couple seasons on some of the work that I do on kind of that evaluation stage and seeing what tools work, because we focus so much time on water hemp that we have neglected the grasses overall. We saw more grass pressure this year. Of course, we got a little bit different rain pattern this year than we had in the past too. So we saw a little bit more grasses. Definitely something we need to work more on and to talk more about.
I think for our listeners too, we have enough that do grow sorghum, and Johnson grass is this kind of a in the genus of sorghum, correct? So it's kind of for them to picture how aggressive sorghum is. That you imagine that, but now it's a weed. And would you agree with that, Dan, or how,
yeah,
maybe be how you're seeing it's growing and that if you do compare it to that sorghum that we think it was maybe close to.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. They are very similar. And from 5 feet apart, unless you've seen them both and worked with them a lot, you may mistake the two. Very, very easy to mistake the two. That's absolutely 100% easy to do. So this is one of those weird weeds. It's not like water hemp and lamb's quarter. There's not some obvious differences from the road that you can pick up on. It is a little bit trickier weed. So if you're growing sorghum on your farm, you probably have some sorghum that maybe comes up the next year, escapes or whatever, and that's fine. That's no big deal. Certainly, what we're looking for is those giant plants at the end of the season that are growing on the field edge, the field corners, places where we don't use glyphosate. Those are some areas where we need to be concerned about, just for the fact that they're very aggressive. There was definitely yield loss in the cornfield that we saw. There has been cases where we see it in soybeans, but where we've gone out, we've scouted those fields, it's just on the field edges. So it like migrates from the seeds. That's where our hypothesis is. We're just tilling it. We're moving the seed kind of along with the field cultivator, moving it further into the field. Whereas if the rhizomes are spreading it, we'd see really concentrated pockets of it, almost like the various invasive grasses that grow in the road ditches, that they just kind of, you know, the miscanthuses and different things kind of just spread along. We'd see something similar with a Johnson grass invasion, but we're not seeing that. So it's good news for now. But I guess when I was crop scouting as a intern just before going into college, I was scouting a lot of fields in the northern Illinois drained swamplands, and we had this weed called water hemp. And I was told that, oh, that's water hemp. It grows in the wet areas. We don't need to worry about it because we kill it with Roundup. Well, it's been a really good job security. So
yeah.
It's been a widespread approach.
So is that kind of your standing theory of how it got so in that one field, was that the seed just got pulled in during tillage? And so it wasn't like a equipment carried in or something else that brought it in, you don't think? Or
maybe a waterfowl case from where it's at. And that seems to be a lot of the weeds that we get in certain parts of the state, or we're moving around with some waterfowl and with combines too.
Sure.
Seems like we get a lot of weed seeds introduced those two ways. But it seems like just purely a homegrown population, possibly brought in a long time ago and slowly built up, and then they grew conventional corn for a couple years and it exploded. There was just no tool thrown at it that would control it. So hoping to do some plot work at that farm or at a similar site this next year, just to really confirm our hypotheses that we can control it with glyphosate, and there's other tools in the toolbox. And what's more than likely happening in these cases is where we're seeing it, we're clearly, like, one of the best cases we have is very close to Interstate 3990 down in Janesville, Rock County. We've kept an eye on this population for a little bit of time too. And wherever the field's being sprayed, it's non-existent. So it's probably coming up, being sprayed just like any other grass, being killed when it's very small. But where it's not being sprayed on that field corner where the spray boom doesn't quite get good coverage, we're seeing it just fill in that corner every single year. So interesting to look at. Not anything to be alarmed with today, I don't think. Keep growing your sorghum. Don't worry about Johnson grass today for the most part of the state. But like I said, we have seen it in more counties than what we thought. And we just sent this out to our regional extension educators to look for it. And within a week, we confirmed it in six or seven counties. So it's pretty startling to see that, yeah, it's actually out there in more places than we thought.
Sure. Any other new weeds or any other, I guess, movement as far as existing weeds that have been maybe in pockets that are spreading or not spreading, hopefully?
Yeah, so Johnson grass is that up-and-coming weed. Right now, we're not entirely certain that it's overwintering, which is good news. And the other one that we're not entirely certain that's overwintering is palm ramrath. So we have a few cases of palm ramrath.
That's great news. Great news. That could be huge for us, Stan.
Yes.
I mean, that's awesome.
Yeah. So palm ramrath's a desert plant. It likes hot temperatures. It's a relative of water hemp, but it's a beast compared to water hemp. It produces many more seeds. It grows to be about, again, 12 feet tall in corn, and is very competitive. But on the fields that we've scouted and we've seen it on, it just doesn't seem like it comes back like water hemp. So the seeds may not be overwintering as well. Palm ramrath and water hemp as well, for listeners at home, spread through seeds. They produce hundreds of thousands of tiny seeds that look like about the same size as a writing pen tip. So very small. Those seeds can hide in every piece of equipment you have, on your shoes. They can migrate around very easily. Waterfowl like to eat amaranthus species, and then combines do an excellent job of harvesting and holding onto them. What's really unique about water hemp and palm ramrath both is about 99% of their seed is retained until they're mechanically separated from the plant. So if we're looking at a field of water hemp, say in High Lake soybeans, which we'll probably get to here in a little bit, we see that unfortunate weed escapes of water hemp in some of those cases where we don't have all the tools we do in some of the other soybean varieties. When we harvest those fields, all those water hemp seeds are being mechanically separated by the combine. Most of them are spit out the back. Some are stuck in various places. Same is true for palm ramrath. So they're retained until harvest, and then we harvest those fields. We spread the seed. What's really interesting, though, is even in neighboring fields to some of these train wrecks that we've seen with palmer, we're not seeing palm ramrath take over. Whereas with water hemp, we saw a lot of neighbor-to-neighbor spread and a lot of migration from farm to farm. On one particular case, we've helped a producer who had unfortunate entire 250-acre field of palm amaranth. They were a non-GMO producer, growing a lot of organic crops as well. And we went in there and talked with them, scouted their fields, saw a lot of amazing water palm amaranth plants, not a lot of water hemp, which was interesting, and learned their full history. And it sounded like that had migrated to their farm through straw that a neighbor had bought for their livestock out west. Not an uncommon kind of movement of palm amaranth, but what we recommended was if you could possibly do it economically, grow alfalfa. So they planted alfalfa 3 seasons ago. I visit this field every year. It's right on the highway. I'm able to drive by it. And I've scouted it the last couple seasons with the producer. The population's gone. The population's crashed. So they moldboard plowed it. And then they planted alfalfa for 3 years, harvested some really good alfalfa. And now this last season, it was back in corn. There was a few palm amaranth plants in the corn, but it was very limited. Obviously, we have great potential to build the population back up because one plant can produce 500,000 seeds, but we're not as concerned about it. So it's really cool to see that. Weeds are one of those cases where it's once you have them, it's tough to get rid of them, but there are some cultural options that are hard resets, like the moldboard plow, like bringing in cover crops, like bringing in alfalfa. If you can do those economically, they're a one-time tool, though. We want to rotate those tools because if you say, well, gosh, I moldboard plowed my palm amaranth field this last year. I have no palm amaranth plants except for, you know, one every 20 feet. I'm going to plow again and get rid of all of them. Well, if you plow again, you'll flip all of those palm amaranth seeds that haven't broken down yet back on top of the soil surface.
Dan, how much, that brings me into a question of tillage and what specifically is helping? I think moldboard is one. Are you seeing some tillage that are actually like, are hurting us? And then is there some scenarios where like no-till, where if this isn't overwintering well, we're leaving it on the top, is actually maybe helping?
Yeah, it's got to be a decision with great agronomists like yourselves and with a producer, because there's pros and cons to everything that you just said, Todd. Probably the biggest pro to any tillage would be burying the majority of the seed and letting it break down. The challenge is we have to do a secondary pass in the spring. So when we do that secondary pass in the spring, we get a really good weed flush because we're essentially planting those weed seeds at a really ideal depth and really ideal conditions because we're planting our corn and soybeans. So that's a tough call to make. I'm not a fan of tillage because I've spent most of my career in the driftless region where I see a lot of soil erosion. Unlike you guys, where it's a little bit flatter, there's a little bit more options for tillage too. With tillage and weed seed control, it's a tool in the toolbox, and it might be a case where we can go after some weeds with tillage, bury those effectively, break those seeds down. On average, a palm amaranth or water hemp seed takes about 4 years to completely die, you know, under the soil surface. Essentially, that seed coating is cracked and broken down and microbes eat it, insects eat it rather. So it does take a little while. If we have other weeds, though, it can be 17 years for a velvet leaf seed to break down and become no longer grow. So just depends on what weeds you're battling. And then finally, to kind of wrap that up, it's got to be a decision based on what's worked in the past too for your weeds on your farm. Row cultivation might be an option to throw out some stuff. It's non-conventional. It's something we don't think a lot about, but how do we think outside the box for these really troublesome cases?
We're going to end up having to go to these old tillage tools that we put in the woods or in the back 40 that we figured we'd never use if you're talking about cultivation units and moldboard plows. So that definitely some of these challenging weeds might send us down that road again. And if you're saying, Dan, that Palmer is a beast compared to water hemp, I don't know if I can fathom that. That's uncalled for, Dan.
Yeah. Our friends from Nebraska say, if you want to get rid of water hemp, plant Palmer. So
there you go.
we got to find a way to sell this Palmer to something productive.
Feed it to dairy. Well,
yeah, if we could feed it, yeah. That would be the best. Yeah,
I 100% agree. I think looking more at feeding amaranthus species in general would be really, really interesting because they grow so well in our climate. They take over. The challenge is our neighbors who grow soybeans are not going to be happy with this. So.
Dan, have you seen any, you know, this was a few years ago, and I think it came out of Australia, they had like a weed crusher system that on the back of the combine, and, you know, there seemed to be a lot of talk about it a number of years ago that, oh, maybe they'll start producing that on combines here. Have you seen any more with that, or do you have any idea where that's gone?
Yeah, the Harrington Seed Destructor was invented by a farmer in Australia, a really cool piece of equipment. Essentially, it was taking all the biomass off the combine, and it was pulverizing it through a cage mill. So a cage mill spins weed seeds at each other, and the whole goal of that machine is to crack the seed coat. Really great technology. I think this has really good, promising research results behind it as well for our conventional and organic producers to be able to bring a tool to their farm and get rid of the weed seeds after they've gone to seed. It was a kind of an expensive tool in the toolbox. The machine that I saw was closer to $200,000. I think it was like $180,000, burned about a gallon or 2 gallons per acre of fuel. It had its own standalone engine. They've since modified that machine. I've heard that you can buy that with a new combine. I asked one of the equipment dealers this fall about that. That was not entirely true, but there's some options where you can add these now onto your combine. Adding a cage mill, and they work with even corn biomass. So think about all the residue we have with corn. They will even work in those scenarios. There's been some work where they windrow that residue, either ran through a destroyer machine or not, and then burn it. Not necessarily a tool that we're going to recommend a lot, probably in Wisconsin, but there's been some work in Missouri done on that. So any of those tools to kind of concentrate the weed seeds and try and break them up or leave them on the soil surface in some sort of high residue system where they're going to have a lot of moisture and they'll break down naturally instead of essentially being broadcast spread by the combine. Those were very effective against like water hemp.
Yeah. With the last couple of really dry falls we've had, burning windrows, I don't think would be definitely an advisable practice.
No. And we have enough challenges with our intersection of the native forest lands and the ag lands as it is that, just doesn't seem like an option to look at. When we first started seeing that come onto the landscape down in Missouri, it seemed like a tool in the toolbox, but probably not where our natural areas and native vegetation interact with the cropland so much. It would not be a good idea, of course. What is interesting is the concept of weed seed management in the fall. And I think that there's a lot of room for this on Wisconsin farms. We've done a lot of work on combine cleaning, where we've done some research work where we've taken samples from combines, we've taken samples from the head, the rock trap, the feeder house, and the rotor, and grown them out in the greenhouse. Thank you to everyone who participated in that work. That was back in 2020. And what we found was predominantly the weed seeds hide in the head, the feeder house, and the rock trap. Only 2.4% end up in the rotor. So it's really something that we can think about using a cordless leaf blower from your favorite power tool brand, blow off those areas of the combine before you move on to the next clean field if you're in a weedy field, and really save yourself some headache. It's not going to get everything out of the combine. It's not a switch from, from corn to wheat type clean out, but it is a clean out that seems to be very effective. 30 minutes with a leaf blower, you can make a lot of weed seeds disappear, because think about when you're combining, even in a cornfield, and you go through a patch of lamb's quarter, the head is just full of lamb's quarter for quite a while, and those lamb's quarter are being pulled into the combine from all that corn residue and being spread out the back, causing future problems. So anything we can do to help slow down the kind of explosion of water hemp that we've seen is beneficial. And it's free too, right? Like one of those cordless leaf blowers is $180. You buy it for whatever tool battery you already have. Keep it in the combine cab, blow off the combine, and move on to the next field. If you're having custom combining done, I would definitely pay for it. If I was looking to have work done, I would pay for the custom harvester to clean their equipment before coming to my farm. It's just one of those things where it makes a huge difference in not moving around weed populations. And we've seen many documented cases of water hemp coming to farms from out of state through buying new combines as in used combines, due to them combines. And it leads to a lot of economic challenges, obviously, as we control those weeds we didn't previously have. Now you might be thinking, well, I already have water hemp. My harvester's water hemp is maybe the same water hemp that I have. Well, that might not be true, because we're seeing different biotypes of the water hemp population and different cases of resistance throughout the state. So I would be a little skeptical about that. But if you are seeing water hemp in your fields after you know, your post-emerge herbicide programs have been applied. Think about fall weed seed management, but also think about doing something different for next year. What are we going to change?
No, I think that's great advice. Because we don't want to make our problems worse, and we definitely don't want to share with our neighbors, because then they might share back. So, as far as overwintering, so zero in Wisconsin, or is it like right at the state line is kind of where we're seeing the cutoff for Palmer to overwinter, or do you have any sense of where that is?
I don't have a good sense of that. I thought by now we'd be seeing more Palmer amaranth throughout the state, because every year we get a few reported cases. And this started when I was in grad school. Somebody brought into the office a Palmer amaranth plant that was about as tall as I am, and about, you know, as wide as my arms could stretch. And they had dug it out of a field in southern Wisconsin. And we thought, oh my gosh, it's here. Like, we're going to have this battle. That was back in 2013 or 20, mm-hmm. probably 2013, that was brought into the UW, and we looked at it. And I go by the farm where that came from quite regularly. It's not very far from where I live. And it has not turned into an explosion of Palmer amaranth. So it just doesn't seem like the seed is overwintering. So that's one of the things that Dr. Worley and I talked about recently, was looking more at our species of our biotypes of Palmer amaranth in the state, and seeing if they're truly just not overwintering. The seed's not overwintering, rather. The plants obviously don't, as an annual broadleaf, but the seeds may not be that viable after going through winter. Now, what's tough, though, is if we have some mild winters, maybe that could change.
Sure.
And the winters have been so variable for us that it's really tough to understand what the weeds are really doing. Obviously, the entomologists are struggling with that, with insects as well. But with the weeds, it's really interesting to look at. I'm going to be presenting on that topic of how is our weather changing some of the weeds that we're seeing in southern Wisconsin in a couple of weeks. Definitely seeing Palmer amaranth and Johnson grasses, maybe two weeds that are telling us that they're here by showing up, but not fully taking over like water hemp has, because it just isn't native to the state and not used to our winters yet. But we like to talk a lot about water hemp. Was first documented in Prairie du Chien and in Green Bay in the late 1880s. So it's been around for a long time. We consider water hemp native in the state of Wisconsin, but it's something that in the last 20 years has certainly evolved very rapidly to the technology that we've thrown at it.
That's a big distance to be first documented in way southwest Prairie du Chien and northeast here, but I guess by bodies of water. So
exactly. It was, it started out in the swamps. So
I think you guys could agree, what you said too about Palmer taking over is, we used to have a lot of problems with red root pigweed, you know, just pigweeds in general were a major weed problem in lamb's quarter. And when water hemp came in, it basically almost took away all the red root pigweeds in general. And so I think what you stated earlier about Palmer being able to sort of do that, that's even sort of scarier, that like you say, the more we can just keep it out of this state, the better, and keep it from getting to be a problem here.
Yeah. Yeah. And certainly, and whatever we can do from the time where we think we have it all the way up until we're handling, say, manure that may have the seed in it, is really, we have to be really conscious about what we're doing there. And I think we have been. I think that's why we're so successful in not having a huge outbreak of it, is also thinking about weed management a little bit differently than, say, 10, 15 years ago. But just being really conscious about what's in the fields in the spring and throwing effective tools at it. Because we also, we haven't seen huge train wrecks of it, because we're probably targeting for water hemp. And water hemp and Palmer amaranth control, pre-emergent wise, is very similar with the populations we've seen. So that's been really good news that we're really tackling water hemp well. It's probably why we're defeating Palmer as well. One final quick story on Palmer was a field we scouted that was on a dairy farm, and we found the seed even in the feed. They were grinding their own corn. They were had some big challenges with Palmer. And when I visit our dairy producers, sometimes weed management is not the top of the list. And I understand why. There's a lot of things to do there, and there's a lot of things going on. But they were effectively chopping the entire field of corn and Palmer together. They said the feed quality was great. It was adding some tonnage, but it was escaping to neighboring lands. So when it was going to the neighbor's soybean field, that's when I think there could be some really big challenges with it. So might not be a huge concern for you on your farm, which is fine. But be thinking about, well, if this weed's spreading on my farm, does my neighbor really want it either too?
I think that's a good transition point, Dan, too. You mentioned high oleic beans before, and from a chemical standpoint, we've moved backwards given the popularity of the high oleic beans. Initially, we thought it was going to be for the oil, but it's really turned into a feed additive that a lot of guys want to grow and roast and bring back to the farm to feed the cows. But, we just don't have the same chemical options that we do.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, Matt. I'm really excited about the high oleic soybeans. It's from a weed management perspective, we're thinking back to glyphosate tolerant soybeans again. So it's bringing us back in genetics quite a few years as far as weed control options go. But there's obviously some new technology coming down the pipeline for those. And this season and next, we'll probably see more and more of those options on the marketplace, hopefully. So if you're growing high oleic soybeans and you've grown them for the last couple of years, you know that glyphosate's been the only tool in the toolbox for weed control, has been the only tool effective for, say, broadleafs, but not for water hemp, of course. So when we think about designing a weed control program for high oleic soybeans, the pre-emergent is really the foundation. And there's many, many pre-emergent tools that we can throw into the tank with high oleic soybeans and be very effective. Oftentimes those tools have to be applied before the soybeans are up, maybe within 3 days of planting even. So we have to be really conscious of that. But we have some really old chemistry options that are really effective against water hemp if we apply them pre and can have some clean fields. And there's certainly cases of those clean fields, but there's cases of some fields with a lot of water hemp in them with those high oleic soybeans. So we want to work to prevent that because, of course, that's just taking away from yield significantly. And it's also creating challenges down the road because we're producing millions of water hemp seeds that we're going to have to battle in the future.
Good news is, Dan, you're spot on, because the fields of oleic that I've worked with, if they do have an aggressive pre-emergent herbicide program, they're essentially clean. And they do a good job of taking care of all that. And we've had good, last couple of years have been good for, weather to activate those herbicides, which is always a challenge. But at least in the Northeast here, in the last 2 years, the popularity has really increased. Is it that much increased in the southern part of the state? Or, I know we're so heavy dairy-centric here that that's where the focus is.
Yeah, we've seen interest. In statewide interest, I've seen some predictions where every acre could be high oleic soybeans and we still wouldn't be growing enough for the demand in the future because it's that good a feed. And I have never taken a nutrition class. I know that that's a deficiency I have. I wish I always did. So I don't understand that world as much. I have to read and rely on other experts. But that seems to be really, really cool stuff that we could have another market for soybeans in the state of Wisconsin. The dairy producers want them so bad that we could grow more acres of them. So it's good news that we're getting some more trade options in the high oleics, because the weed control options of just having the Roundup Ready soybean is maybe not as good as it once was.
You just harken back to those days of we're spraying soybeans with Roundup only and the weeds were knee high and you just go out there and spray them and they're clean. It's crazy to think that was only 20 years ago.
And such a cheap option too, right? That's like, even now it's so attractive to attempt that because the economics are so favorable on paper until we take that to the field now. But yeah, 20 years ago, that's, as a weed scientist, that's crazy to imagine. I remember my grandpa cultivating corn for a guy he worked for with probably a 16 row cultivator. And that was the weed control program. I'm sure there was pre's used because you could smell them. So as a kid, I remember smelling the pre's and lived in an area where they certainly used a lot of atrazine and other, older chemistry options that were effective and affordable. And then seeing water hemp take over, seeing the, 8 and 9 different things that we're throwing at water hemp control now in different parts of the country is incredible. And that's because the resistance has just changed. So I think we're lucky in the sense that we're thinking about this in the high oleic soybean system of, we do have some really effective pre's, Bill, as you've seen out in the field and just shared. Right now is the time to be making that plan with your trusted agronomist and think about what we're going to be doing, because come, you know, June 15th or July 1st, you're probably out of options for water hemp control in high lake soybeans, because that water hemp is going to be waist high.
Yeah, and at that point, you can only pull so many plants.
That's right.
I've tried.
There's only so much sunlight in the day to go out and pull weeds. So
I swear they reproduce while you're both that and giant ragweed. I've never been like, oh, we'll just go pull it. It's in one small patch. And then,
yeah, it's just pretty soon your arms are full and you're like, ah, I didn't even get half of this yet. And then I saw more over there, and there's more over there.
Yep. There's a lot of tools in the toolbox. I think hand pulling and roguing some areas is really, really effective. If you have that one patch of whatever weed it is, go out and eradicate it. Make it your goal that you're not going to have giant ragweed next season or lamb's quarter next season. Whatever your troublesome weed is, challenge yourself to just get rid of that. You might have a field full of grasses, but not having giant ragweed next year is a lot better than having grasses and giant ragweed.
And did you call it roguing? I like
that.
Yeah.
I will say using a in 30-inch rows, a weed whacker works very nicely sometimes. Yes. To saves on the pulling and little bit of gas and or battery power, and you can
Do you put like little blades on there, or is it string? Because I would think you'd have to have, you know, them little kits you can put on that the plastic blades come out to help your cause a little bit more. Maybe you just go through string like there's no tomorrow.
I usually stick with the string because I try to get it when it's small.
Oh.
So there's one field in particular on a farm that there's always kind of this ditch area. No matter what we spray, we always seem to get just a patch there. And so I usually, at some point in the summer, am grabbing the weed whacker because I'm out there anyway, and just kind of go through and thin out a patch. And usually it's, yeah, maybe 4 to 6 inches tall, just to make sure I get some of it wiped out so it doesn't become a bigger issue.
The blade is necessary on the 4 to 6 feet tall palm.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
We've had to do that in some research projects. We've got a trimmer with a blade on it. And now I have one at home too, and they're very dangerous to use. So a safety warning for everybody at home to make sure you pay attention to that piece of machinery, but very effective at cutting down large water hemp plants if that's your goal for the summer.
All right. Well, I think one last thing before we wrap things up is earlier this summer you had talked about some tips for growing your own cover crop seed, and that's another way that we haven't really talked about much on this episode yet of helping with your weed suppression, is to get a nice cover crop out there, get some residue that basically, I mean, the way I look at it is it's less real estate for that weed to take over is by having it covered and keep things in. So, and two, we want to make sure we clean any cover crop seed if it's grown on the farm or grown by a neighbor to keep those weed seeds out of it. So any tips there, Dan?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think growing your own cover crop seed is really an interesting area to look at. If you're maybe struggling to get seed, or you're wanting to try something new and can legally grow some of those varieties yourself, let's explore that. So when we think about kind of the scale of what we're looking at, if we're going to grow 5 acres of Ciro rye is going to yield 50, 60 bushels an acre on the lower side of things, or the average side of things. That's substantial amount of seed. If we look at seeding that back at, you know, a bushel per acre, every acre we grow, we've grown 50 bushels of Ciro rye to cover. So, you know, if we grow 5 acres of Ciro rye and we store it in a gravity box with a fan on it, maybe for a couple months, we can get by growing our own Ciro rye. We may or may not be interested in that. If you are interested in that, then you need to be thinking about growing a variety that you can legally grow and reproduce. And then there's also things that you need to be leery of if you're going to resell that Ciro rye. So there's varieties that you can't, you've agreed to just grow that as a cover crop on your own farm. So make sure you look into those things as well. If you're buying it, or if you're harvesting a weedy field, certainly look at having it cleaned. And there's custom seed cleaners around the state. Have one of those come out and clean it. It's very affordable per bushel. You can have your rye cleaned. It's amazing how many seeds come out of that are not rye. If you have a little bit of weedy field, you've harvested all those weeds. If you have a clean field, probably not anything that we really need to worry about. And there's certainly some good herbicide options for growing rye similar to wheat. I've seen some producers really successfully do this. I think it's really cool to look at just growing a small patch of land of cover crop and then replanting it. And then you store it for a few months in a gravity box or one of those pro box type things, and then seed it again. You will have to have it cleaned if you're going to drill it, though. If you're going to run it through a drill, you'll have to have it cleaned because it'll have a lot of shaft in it. Typically, they'll plug things up. I would imagine the same is probably true if you're going to drone seed it. Although I don't have experience in that, I'd be a little bit nervous about that. And then just yesterday, I chatted with someone who's buying an air seeder for their high clearance sprayer. I think probably the same is true for that. So if you're doing anything beyond just a broadcast pass with the 3-point farm store spreader, probably cleaning is going to be something that you need to put on your list for that. That's also something to ask your neighbor if they're growing some seed. Hey, is this cleaned or not? Or can I come out and look at your fields before you harvest it? I don't want to be planting your weed problems too. But it's a way that we can get into cover crops in a very affordable way using equipment we already have.
Dan, are there any other crops? You mentioned cereal rye. Have you had success with kind of any other specific ones, kind of grow your own on the farm? Or is that one maybe the starter one and then you move into certain other things? What else are you seeing for different species?
I think that's the starter one, and that might be as far as I go. Only because there's some, I think, some real disease challenges with barley in the state. I think cereal rye is probably where I'm going to stop with that. But I love the creativity of the Wisconsin farmers trying the different soil health practices. I think that we'll figure out how to grow other stuff because other stuff goes to seed. But the harvesting, the cleaning, the storage is all what makes me a little bit nervous, as well as if I'm growing a cover crop, I really don't want to put a lot of inputs into it. I don't want to probably spray it a bunch of times, different things like that. So how can I kind of stay true to those kind of principles of cover cropping? But I don't know, Todd and Bill and Matt, what would you guys try?
I could see some oats potentially. There's a few growers around the area that grow oats for seed that sell for, you know, farmers that plant oats the following year and their new seedings or what have you. And heck, there's enough deer plot growers around that might buy things of that nature too. So I could see oats being one of them. I think the others might be a little bit of a challenge.
I've got one grower that right now does rye and sells it to some of his neighbors. And he actually bought probably 3-4 years ago, a seed cleaner. And I don't, it was out of state somewhere. He got it and had to go down and pick it up, but, came with a whole bunch of different screens. So he's talked about trying some different species, and clover is actually something that's been grown and harvested for seed in the state previously. So I think that might be something, that we could see some potential in. I actually talked to a farm down by kind of the Princeton area that they used to grow clover on the farm for seed production. So I could see that one potentially being one that that we could go to. And winter wheat, I think, is something that's been used, and some guys are hoping to maybe use that as a cover crop because it doesn't take off like rye does in the spring. And so the, you know, could be another reason to grow wheat and get that in the rotation.
Yeah, I like all those options. If we make them work, let's do it. I think that that's really cool stuff to look at, especially the clovers. There's tremendous interest in clovers, and clover seed is kind of expensive in comparison to other seeds. That's just where the price point is on it. So if we want to get clover into our rotation, maybe trying to grow our own clover seed again is a good use of some marginal acres, some acres that maybe should be set aside type practices too. So let's look at those and let's explore them. A lot of oat producers for seed grow a lot of high quality oats in the state for sure. I'm not overly familiar with that. How do you store that then? So let's figure that out for a cover crop type turnaround.
Yeah, well, we appreciate you taking the time today, Dan, and I know you've got a busy meeting season coming up just like we do, and you're going to be giving some talks and stuff throughout the winter here. I know you and I had talked. You're coming to a Farmer Roundtable meeting down in Oshkosh on February 5th, and a few days after that is the Midwest Cover Crop Council annual meeting down in Dubuque, and you're a part of the Midwest Cover Crop Council, is that correct?
Yeah, I get to help represent Wisconsin on that group. That's a really great group of there's a couple producers in that group. There's some NRCS representatives, and then there's some academia representatives. And it's just as the name says, Midwest states. If you ask me to name them all now, I'm sure I'll leave one out. But they started down in Indiana at Purdue and at Michigan. The Purdue and Michigan have worked together for a long time on cover cropping, and it's just exploded throughout the Midwest. So this year we get to host the 20th annual meeting of the organization in Dubuque with it's a co-hosted meeting with Iowa State. So we've got a really great agenda for day number two. That's in early February. Highly recommend farmers attend this meeting. It's geared for farmers. There's going to be farmers presenting. There's going to be some researchers presenting. It's kind of a pretty wide agenda. There's going to be some livestock because we're going to be still in the driftless region. So we're going to be talking a little bit about livestock and covers, but talking about how can we grow corn and soybeans with cover crops. So we're going to be bringing in some farmers from Iowa, from Wisconsin to present on that very topic. So if you're interested in using cover crops in your corn and soybean rotations, there's going to be some interesting talks. I'm sure there's going to be a lot of cool pictures shown of some practices being done out there in the field. So come on down to Dubuque early February. It is a 2-day meeting. If you can only pick one day, pick day number two. That's going to be the best day for a farmer to attend and an agronomist to attend as well. So looking forward to that. There's also many other speaking engagements that I'm very fortunate to be part of. Really love going out, meeting everybody, chatting and chit-chatting about what we've been working on throughout January and February with local producer-led watershed groups. So keep an eye on those calendars. And then finally, talking about something I've never talked on before, and I'm going to be speaking about using AMS in spray solutions. So a long-term water conditioner, we have a lot of hard water in the state of Wisconsin. I'm going to be presenting on that at the Wisconsin Ag Business Classic in the Dells. So it's going to be a 10-minute talk. Bring your tough questions to that because, again, new to the topic.
Very cool. Well, we'll look forward to seeing you again. I'm sure we'll see you at least one of the meetings, if not more. And, yeah, we appreciate you taking the time and joining us on the podcast again today. So thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Dan.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks, everybody.
Yeah, and thank you guys for being here. And to all our listeners, thanks for listening. And as always, happy farming.